Today this has all changed. A certain number of workers, it is true, will peacefully go to the fields as though nothing were happening. We'll come back, clean the hive, attend to the brood cells, and hold altogether aloof from the general ecstasy. These are the ones that will not accompany the queen. They will remain to guard the old home, feed the 9 or 10,000 eggs, the 18,000 larvae, the 36,000 nymphs, and 7 or 8 royal princesses that today shall all be abandoned.
Left his home and his family, 1869, to make a good life for them. A builder with the hands of a builder, to build the biggest bridge in the biggest town. The hundreds who went down.
Everybody has been asking me for the last 2 days, how do you organize timber workers? How do you organize loggers? How do you get loggers to talk to earth firsters? And the first answer is you have to like loggers. That's the first thing. And I already did because, you know, having been a blue-collar worker my whole adult life, the conditions of my life are actually more similar to them than to the privileged environmentalists in the city. The espresso-sucking pavement dwellers, as we call them. But so being from a rural area myself and being a working-class person myself, I can relate for those reasons. A lot of it really depends on your attitude. The thing that happens is people who are more educated or who are from urban areas tend to really look down, especially on rural working people. Actually, what I've discovered from a lifetime of being a non-achiever is that intelligence is it's equally distributed among the social classes. But there's a tendency of urban people to look down and consider the timber workers stupid, to talk down to them, to things like that. I've heard a 21-year-old college student say to a 45-year-old logger, "Do you know what biodiversity is?" And, you know, if you do that, that's the end of the conversation. So what I actually do is I just talk to people, that's all. I mean, it's been incredibly easy because there's nobody speaking for the timber workers out there. The Wise Use Movement, the anti-environmentalists, those people are management. In fact, if you actually know them and who they are low-level management. They're fronting for the corporations, but they're not the workers. Nobody's speaking for the workers. The unions have mostly been smashed or corrupted themselves, and the actual interest of the workers is not expressed in the political spectrum in the timber wars. So what I did was, well, one of them is having some respect for them as intelligent human beings. Instead of telling the timber workers what to do, which is the other mistake environmentalists always make, I asked them. And I asked them to tell me about their working conditions and their lives. And the way I would meet them, by the way, is we'd blockade them. And, you know, here they are, and we're chained to their truck. They're not going anywhere. And, and that actually is really how I started meeting timber workers. And, you know, they're kind of curious about these people who are audacious enough to actually hike into the middle of nowhere in the woods and put their bodies on the line. So as I began to hear their stories, and I didn't even do this consciously, I began to give them a forum. By listening to them, by asking them instead of telling them, I really not only learned a lot of wisdom from them, but also began to build this alliance by advocating for the timber workers' issues in the community. And it didn't have to be save the trees. I advocated for workplace issues separately, understanding that it's the same thing, you know, that the workplace issues are neither separate from nor subordinate to the forest issues. They're all part of corporate exploitation of the earth and the people.
Thank you.
town.
So that we just heard was called River Bird Serenade. Ryder, tell us about that song that you wrote.
It's played by a band called Fall Harbor, which is me and my collaborator, Todd Chandler. And the song was written in North Adams, Massachusetts. That's where Mass Mocha is, and there's also a lot of other artists and some little art centers and galleries there. I was doing a project at an art center called Contemporary Artist Center, and a lot of these art facilities are in old factories and mills. So that song was written about, or sort of in honor of, the old garment worker factories, and thinking about the workers who worked there. And the story of it is invented in my mind, but I imagined this factory worker walking to work every day and collecting feathers on her way to work. And then underneath her little workstation, she would have a secret area where she kept the feathers. And when no one was looking, she was sewing a dress made of golden thread, and she was sewing the feathers into it. And then when it was finished, she opened a window and put the dress on, and she turned into a bird, and she flew out the window, and she thought she was going to fly away, but then she looked back and she saw the other garment workers through the window, and she realized that she had to stay and serenade them from the window.
That's a beautiful story.
You know, the interesting thing is that we will probably be playing that song this weekend, or if not this weekend, next weekend in North Adams. The band Fall Harbor is playing both weekends at Mass Mocha.
So now I wanted to talk about what was just before that, which was a 3-minute clip of a talk by the late, great Judy Berry. Judy Berry was active in the fight to save the ancient redwood forests in Northern California. She was a member of Earth First, and she was an incredible bridge and transformer of the environmental movement by bringing her labor organizing background to the environmental movement and really shifting, for the first time, trying to build bridges between the loggers and the people who are fighting to save the forests and identifying common concerns. And really powerful, incredible, fierce activist and thinker. And that was just a portion. I wanted to let people know who are interested in finding out more about Judy Berry that there is a radio program called Revolutionary Ecology that you can get at radioforall.net. And there's also a very wonderful documentary film about Judy Berry's case against the FBI and Oakland Police Department, which is a whole other story, called The Forest for the Trees by Bernadine Mellis. And speaking of bridges, the first song was also off the new Fall Harbor CD. Tell us about that, Ryder.
The first song is called The Hundreds, and it's actually about the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. And apparently a lot of workers died building this bridge. And in one part of the song, for example, we have this part that's about the caissons. The caissons of a bridge are this special work chamber that's built underwater, where the water is pumped out, and then the air compression is made so that people can breathe underwater while they're working. A lot of workers apparently got a disease from working in these caissons and died, and they also some people didn't die and they had what's called the caisson's disease or the bends just for the rest of their life, where they couldn't really ever stand up straight, I believe.
Really fascinating story, and a story that often gets told without the really crucial labor element of it.
Yeah.
I think there's also a documentary about the building of the Brooklyn Bridge that shares a lot of that information, but
I don't know so many of the details because Todd wrote that song. He's more of an expert.
Well, so that was Todd Chandler's composition performed by Fall Harbor called The Hundreds. And we're gonna move on and talk some more about superstructures and distributions and honey.
I want to mention that we did some last-minute rearranging, and we had Jason Martin programmed for this show, and now we're moving him to a later show. So come back every Wednesday, and you'll hear some readings from Jason Martin.
Sometimes you will find some discrepancies in the announcements about what will be on the show, but you will always find information on the, if you go to the blog, which is colonycollapsedisorder.wordpress.com, you'll be able to hear the shows and find information and links to the artists, and it'll all eventually be up there. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back in a bit.
Most of the time when we're talking about any social movement, we actually are seeking the redistribution of something, right? Jobs or land or money, but it's not always called that, you know, it's called some kind of rights or something. And that suggests that something like adheres to the person or to the group. And the idea of redistribution is about like a systemic shift, and it incorporates large scale things like taxation and the drawing of national boundaries. And it also requires us to think about what would I lose or gain? It's a very personal thing. If things were as I think they should be, whatever that is, whatever you believe in, what would I have? And how would I make that politics real in the way I'm living right now? The way I live distributes things, whether it's how I spend money or how I take in money or how I work or whatever, and if I think things are poorly distributed in the world, what would I do to redistribute them? And how could I take responsibility for that? Given, of course, the like enormous feelings of insecurity that we all have about changing the distribution of things for fear that we might lose something. So it's about trying to like bring up those questions.
Honey! I've often said that I'd like to do away with money, because I think that's a concept that's, it's so foreign in a way, and it doesn't mean anything. I always, I'm sure I've probably said this to you before, I think of this thing that one writer has said, if all the money in the world were to disappear tomorrow, we'd have no either more nor less in the world than we have today. It's a way of somehow, if we, it's our faith in it that makes it possible to have that, and so that some people can have so much and some people have so little. And I often think of the fact that if you took Bill Gates and you put him out in the wilderness, I wonder how much could he produce? Why does he have so much money and command the labor of so many of us, and then can be so wonderful and philanthropic, as a matter of fact, you know? But and also, just even from a practical point of view, the way we use money now, things have to keep growing and growing and growing. If you're going to have the wealth the way we have it, what we call it, and there's interest on it and so forth, so it has to keep growing and growing and growing. And it's crazy. It's ridiculous.
Money, 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 money. Nothing but money.
Five stars in the PM, and I love the sunrise, so I step out in the AM. The street is black and shiny from the nightly rain. The glory of the light brings evaporation. Mornings fresh, oxygen cleanest. I take a deep hit, help my mind stay the greenest. I'm already awake, so I'm not drinking coffee. Don't want a cigarette, cause it's a form of slavery. Walk into the store, cause I need a few items. The sun heats my blood, like a hit of vitamins. I need to buy some food for my dreads. I can't remember why, but I need a spool of thread. Well, a man with dirty dreads, he steps around the corner. He asks me for a dime, a nickel or a quarter. I don't have any change, so I'm stepping along. But as I'm walking past, he sings to me a song. There's a hole in the bucket. I'm humming the song. The buses and the people all keep moving along. To the shopkeeper, I say, what's up? And I'm thinking about the man who's holding up the cup. I pay for all the stuff and get a pocket full of change. Well, should I give it to the man? It's a question in my brain. What's gonna happen if I give the man a dime? I don't wanna pay for another brother's wine. What's gonna happen if I give the man a quarter? Will he find a dealer and try to place an order? What's gonna happen if I give the man a nickel? Will he buy some food or some pork that's been pickled? I'm not responsible for the man's depression. How can I find compassion in the midst of a recession? How can all these questions keep with my head? And I still can't remember why I need a spool of thread. There's a hole in the bucket. There lies a there's a hole in the bucket. As I'm walking past, I'm trying to avoid him cause I know he's gonna ask me about the coinage that is in my pocket. But I don't know if I should put it in his pocket.
I walk right past to think about it more. Back at the crib, I'm opening up the door. A pocket full of change don't mean a lot to me. My cup is half full, but his is empty. I put back on my cap and I start heading back. I reach into my pocket and I have a heart attack. Well, as I'm digging deep, I scream, oh no. There's nothing in the pocket but a great big hole. Well, I was busy thinking if he would buy smack. The jingle in my pocket slipped through the cracks. No one has a change and it's f***ing up my head. But now I know the reason why I had to buy the thread. Cause there's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza. There's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza. There's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza. There's a hole in the bucket. Dear Liza.
Speaking of the relationship between the beekeeper and the hives, I'm curious about this idea of surplus and hoarding behaviors. If the humans didn't take honey and force the bees to produce more than they need, what would happen in the hive? Would they continue to produce as much honey as they possibly could and then swarm more? Or what would happen?
Well, actually, the hoarding is an evolved behavior in bees that come from temperate parts of the world or the cold regions of the world that have a clear winter, distinct winter. And the reason, of course, they do that in the natural world is because in the winter they have to have food. Bees are active all winter. They may slow down and stay in a tight ball to stay warm, but every time it warms up, like today, we're in the middle of January and we have all these bees flying around because I put some honey out to see how they were doing. And so that's what they do. And of course, if you take honey from the bees at the right times, it actually encourages them to collect more surplus. Now, a wild colony that filled up with honey would reach a point where there's no more room to store honey. And at that point, yes, they would stop foraging. But as soon as they stop foraging, they become very crowded in the hive and what we call congested in the brood nest. And this triggers their desire to basically create another colony somewhere else. And that's where swarming it starts. So probably if you just left your bees full of honey all year round, they would swarm more frequently. So that's how they would maintain a nice balance of numbers of bees versus food. If they got plenty of food, that inspires them to swarm and start a new colony somewhere else. And they would raise a replacement queen before they left. And generally the old queen takes about half the bees, with the majority of them being younger bees, so they'd live longer, so there's more opportunity to establish a new nest. And they would actually carry a lot of honey with them in their honey stomachs. And I've often been quite amazed at swarms that I've caught that I've put into hives that have drawn out comb that's empty, and overnight they will often fill up frames of that just with the honey they're carrying, and the honey will sometimes be four and five frames of honey that these bees are just carrying, a little bit each one, but altogether it's a lot of food. So they would take some of that with them, and probably it's one of the reasons swarming is triggered by abundance of food. So that's what happens in the natural world. It's all survival. Honeybees are very good at what they do, and those surpluses are again part of their natural the dynamics of the various seasons they go through. And so I would say in wild colonies, you have more swarms.
So it's not that if humans stop taking honey, the bees would then go on a vacation and stop doing the work?
No, they would stop maybe foraging because they have no more room. But what typically happens, any beekeeper will tell you that during really periods when there's a lot of nectar coming in, sometimes they fill up the brood nest too, where normally they would raise young bees, because they've run out of space everywhere else, and they'll draw comb in every nook and cranny trying to create more space. And then they'll move it into the brood nest, which will shrink the brood nest, which means a queen can't lay as much because there's no empty cells anymore after a certain point. And we do have a term for that. We call it being honey bound. And although you don't see it frequently, because most beekeepers will add extra space on top by putting another box on with more comb. And that way the bees keep working upward and they don't get the honey bound situation. But generally, when those kind of things happen, again, it leads to swarming. Suddenly the queen has got nothing to do, all the workers have nothing to do, and they're saying, gee, you know, we're awful crowded here, let's go find another home.
There's a guy who wrote this book in the 70s that I've not read, but someone told me about it, where he calculated what, if you redistributed everything in the world, what everybody would have to live on. Have you heard about him? And so it was something like $7,000 a year or something, and he just lives off that. Because that's our dream, right? If you, maybe you should live in the world now as much as possible as if it were the world you want to live in, right? That's the a concept of making your politics real. And that is a very extremely literal, absolutist sort of way to do it. But he's saying if everyone did this, everyone would have enough, right? I thought that was a nice thing to have in the mix of the conversation, you know?
And it's really different from saying everyone needs to do this right now and this is how it's, this is the only way it's going to go down.
I mean, I think that's the thing that I'm looking for. Can we do models and not absolutism? So could we think there's a lot of ways to think about living a redistributionist life and they're all going to be imperfect? And so what if we just started risking it, trying out things that appeal to you? So for some people, they'll want to start in what they eat. And for some people, they'll want to start in what they wear. And for some people, they'll want to start in, you know, giving money away to a nonprofit. Some people want to give it to homeless people. That there's not a better way to do it, but that there's a set of conversations that would happen if we all shared those strategies and if we all actively thought it was neat to develop them.
Thank you.
our desires fuel war. I may believe that I don't desire war and I do desire gadgets or clothing or whatever, you know, food from far away or whatever it is, but to say actually those, that is a desire for war. Those things can only be possible to consume and desire and have in a context in which there's, you know, neoliberalism and empire and all the things that are going on. So I think that kind of connection is really amazing. I think the danger in that, the difficult thing is that we have to really avoid absolutism in this, which is so hard. I've been thinking a lot about how some communities that I'm in will have a shared absolutist view. So like, I think nobody in my friend circles would drive an SUV. That's passé or it's tacky. It's, you know, it's almost taken on a cultural norm. It's not just, people would articulate it as like a concern about gas use and all kinds of things, but it's
uncool.
It's uncool. And I'm always thinking, like, you know, how could I make something like the cell phone, like, just considered just, like, tacky? You know what I mean? Because even though the whole point of that cool, uncool, tacky, untacky is ultimately a capitalistic understanding of belonging based on your possessions or not belonging, you know, like, it's just image-oriented, you know, it's really useful politically when people, that's part of how people make something possible for each other in this context, right? Like, if it becomes okay in the world of people your age to be queer, then you might be more likely to be able to do it, or to be trans, or to not be married, or, you know, or to be married, or whatever all those things are. Like, we are about coolness, you know, we are about group dynamics because we are human, we live in communities of care, and those things through capitalism become really status oriented. But so trying to think about both how we can avoid absolutes, but also if we could build, knowing that about ourselves, build shifted desire, because part of that's about desire. So if I could be like, that person's really hot because they raise bees and live in a house that has gray water usage or something, instead of because they look so good in their iPod, you know. And obviously there's some of this in like the kinds of communities that you and I are both in. There's a lot of desire around alternative living and admiring people because of their beautiful creative skills, but there's also a lot of things that are not that. And so how could we take that kind of valuation so not only what makes us think people are sexy, but also what makes us feel secure. Part of this for me is like, makes people feel secure to have a retirement account. I'm scared of being the only old person without kids, you know, and blah, 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 all the things that fuel people, or I'm afraid not being able to take care of my lover, whatever it is. And so what if that fear, instead of making you have a retirement account, made you give more money to like people fighting to maintain Social Security benefits or to eliminate the poverty for the elderly in the U.S. or whatever the hell the answer is in your world, you know? If we could fuel a collectivity as a desire instead of an individual answer as a desire, that's the thing that I've been trying to think about.
That was Dean Spade. We've had little excerpts from a conversation I had with Dean Spade throughout this half of the show. You can find out more about Dean's thoughts about enoughness and wealth redistribution and a whole host of other really pertinent and interesting and complicated issues. One way to find some of Dean's writings is to go to makezine.org. There was also an interview with him in Clamor recently. You also heard from Dan Conlin of Warren Colors Apiary talking about hoarding behaviors of the bees, and also Spearhead doing Hole in the Bucket, and Juanita Nelson, an 84-year-old war tax resister since 1948, on money. Our original intention with this show was to have a section about war tax resistance as one approach to wealth redistribution and anti-war activism. We're running out of time, so I wanted to invite all of you both to check out the National War Tax Resisters Committee at nwtcc.org, and to also check out our blog, colonycollapsedisorder.wordpress.com. I'll have an excerpt from an interview with Mary Regan, a war tax resister since the 80s, and some more links about getting involved with that, because tax time is coming up. It's something to consider. A huge portion of our taxes are going to the current and past wars as well.
We actually had a caller from a great worker out there who has given up honey eating. She now eats only agave nectar, although she's looking into if this has an effect on the cactuses that it comes from. Mm. But she likes to eat now just locally, and she has her own chickens, and her name is Wendy.
That's nice. Thanks for calling, Wendy. Ooh, I don't want to forget also that Christine Shields and Jaina B's piece Bee Train played just before Dean Spade, and that was a really excellent contribution that we got for the show.
Are we now going to do a reading about from Agonitha, the artist?
I think we're up to date. I think okay. We're ready. So these are the words of Agonitha Dick, a Canadian artist who collaborates with the Bees, sculptress.
We're actually taking this out of an interview that was conducted with her. So E.E. will be the interviewee, and I will be Agonitha.
The interviewer. I'm trying to find the question for this one. It seems that we were talking about computers and dystopia and interconnectedness. And there was a question about the social order. Mm. What about the social order?
Well, people seem to think that apiary work is natural. They don't think anything at all about the fact that we take the honey or who built the hive boxes. There's a whole artificial thought of what natural is. So as soon as the bees make art, people think that it's not natural anymore. And yet it's the most natural thing that they do, because they will build in anything or on anything. They just build anywhere.
So do you think that says something, too, about human nature in this sense of building or making art or making language, that it's impossible to decide if these activities are necessarily cultural or natural?
I think it's so mixed up. You can't divide it. I can't. I don't know enough about it. We will return to you with more from Agonitha on upcoming shows.
Here's some Patti Smith.
Till I can rest, 11 steps. this by you.
Workers, a poem by Nick Flynn. After the 7 month slumber, honey stupored and warm, we unfold our wings, shake off the hive, set out for buckwheat and the low flowers of spring. We work ourselves ragged, each day going out, to come back heavy with nectar and pollen. Seconds collapse. In 7 weeks we fall, dried out husks, ravaged lace. Long winter we huddled for warmth. Our bodies the lamp, honey the fuel that kept us.
The end of Colony Collapse Disorder Radio, show number 3, Superstructures. Please tune in next week at 10 a.m. where we will move on to Foreign Invaders 1. Thanks so much for listening.
Two steps till I'm blessed.